Amen. We're in, you know, we're taking a little sidebar to dig deeper as the spiritual being that Daniel has an encounter with in chapter 10 has pulled back the veil to talk about dark forces that are moving in the world. And he talks about them moving in the governments. We're going to start in Matthew 25 this evening. That's going to take maybe this week and maybe one more week before we get back to our text in Daniel to think deeply about some of these things, because I think we need to be aware that we use the little statement that Great Adventure Clubs used for a long time, way back when, the Whitbeat, which a little shirts that Mom had made up, and people were like, what's a Whitbeat? And you'd be like, well, every word in the Bible is absolutely true. We believe that and we hold to that. And so even the weird parts, and sometimes some people say wherever the weird parts are, that's the parts that's important. And so we're going to look at some of those things so that we're better aware. And I want to start out with some questions first, just to start thinking about, because sometimes we go through and look at all the answers, but if we don't have the questions, you know, it doesn't mean as much. But some of this we talked about last week, like when did Lucifer fall? A lot of people try to put it, oh, in ancient times in the past, and we know that it was after creation, you know, but sometime after that, those 7 days, sometime in there. So it's not this distant past. We talked about the gap theory and some other things. So, but when did Lucifer fall? So we need to think about that. It's relative then. Did all the angels fall with him all at once? Is a question to ponder. Why are some of the angels locked up and some of the angels aren't that were fallen? I want to kind of address that one tonight. Why is Lucifer still free? You know, I said, why are some are locked up and some still roam around? Are demons fallen angels? Is hell's Lucifer's kingdom? Is this his realm? Is it a battle of heaven and hell? This is his forces all gathered here in his kingdom versus God in his kingdom? Is that how it is? Some questions I think we should have. Because it should all make sense. And God's word should be consistent. It should flow. And I think the more you look at all these things, and we will look at some different things, that it should all make sense and flow together, and I think that it does. But Matthew 25 is where we are. Let's look at this here first and answer some questions right off the start. So verse 31, Matthew 25, 31 says, and when the Son of Man shall come into his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. And before him shall he gather all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. He shall set the sheep on the right hand, and the goats on the left. And then shall the king say unto them on the right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom, prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee and hungered and fed thee, and thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick and in prison and came unto thee? And the king's answered, or the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. Then shall I say to them on the left hand, depart from ye, ye accursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. Then they answered him, and saying, Lord, when saw we thee a hungered, or thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, and in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer unto them, saying, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you did it not to the one of the least of these, you did it not unto me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. So there's a time when the nations will come before the Lord, and he's going to divide them and separate the sheep from the goat. We call this passage the sheep-goat judgment. But look at verse 41. It tells us something crucial here. It says, then he shall say unto them on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. So this gives us an answer to one of the questions I ask at the beginning. Hell is not Satan's kingdom. I don't think he's been anywhere near there. I don't think he's ever visited. I don't think he flirts with it. I think he probably stays as far away as possible. It's his jail. You know, it's his prison. It's his punishment. It's not a place or a kingdom that he rules from. It's the place he will be sentenced to, and then he'll be locked up in. And so, no, he's not there. And it's not made for just him. It's made for him and his angels. And so we learn that he has angels. And so there are angels that are on his side. We also learn that it's not made for mankind. So when men die and go to hell, they are unwelcome guests in a place that was meant to house fallen angels, which is terrifying to me. It's like it's not even made for man. And you're going to go someplace that's full of these creatures that rebelled from heaven, and you're going to spend eternity with them, which is adds to the hellishness of hell to me. So God's kingdom is made for men, but the devil's kingdom is not a kingdom. It's a punishment. And so it's just something that he puts a spin on to make it sound like he has all this against him. I know Jesus uses the term once, the gates of hell will not prevail against it. But they're trying to get out. They're trying to get loose. And we prevail. Devil here means slanderer or accuser. Like we mentioned, the Satan, the accuser. It's Lucifer and his angels. So he has these angels that it mentions as well. Let's look at another one in Matthew 8. We're going to look at several of these here pretty quick. If you've never done a study where you've gone and called harmonize the Gospels, or you take the Gospels and look at them where they repeat on the certain stories, we'll do this in brief here tonight. We're going to look at the same account in three spots. Matthew 8, verse 28 says, "And when he come to the other side of the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two possessed with devils." We all know this one. "Coming out of the tombs, exceeding fierce, so that no man might pass by that way. And behold, they cried out, saying, 'What have we to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God? Art thou come hither to torment us before the time?' And there was a good way off from them a herd of many swine feeding. So the devils besought him, saying, 'If thou cast us out, suffer us to go into the herd of swine.' And so he said unto them, 'Go.' And they went and they came out," and we know that they all run down the hill. Let's finish it here. It says, "And they came out and they went into the herd of swine. And behold, the whole herd of swine ran violently down a steep place into the sea and perished in the waters. And they that kept them fled and went their ways into the city and told everything that was befallen to the possessed of the devils. And behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus. And when they saw him, they besought him that he would depart out of their coast," which is a strange ending to a story about, about an area that is plagued with these demon-possessed guys. That's the briefest encounter, so I want to look at it first. But look at verse 29. These devils, it calls them in this passage. One, they know who Jesus is. They have knowledge. They have intelligence. They know who he is without him being told. You know, here he's just getting out of the boat. Walk up to him. "What have you to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God?" They know who he is. "Art thou come hither to torment us before the time?" They know that there is a time of judgment that is reserved for them. And they know that they cannot escape it. They know they're on borrowed time. And so this is some of the knowledge that they have. Let's look and see what Mark's encounter have. Mark chapter 5, verse 1. We'll just read the first part here because he gives us some different details. And so that's why it's always good, like at a crash report, you know, you want to get as many eyewitnesses as you can because everybody stands and sees a little bit different, got a different viewpoint. Mark gives us some more details. Mark 5, verse 1. "And they came over into the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes. And when he was come up out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, and had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains, because that he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces, neither could any man tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. But when he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and worshipped him. And he cried with a loud voice and said, 'What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not.' And then again he begs to be thrown into the sheep or going to possess the sheep because he seeks embodiment. And they run down and get killed. But he gives us a different detail in verse 13. "And forthwith Jesus gave them leave, and the unclean spirits went out and entered into the swine, and the herd ran down a steep place into the sea, and there were about 2,000. So 2,000, this is a big herd of pigs here. And they were choked in the sea. So 2,000 of them. So if each one of them were possessed, you know, you're thinking, well, how many could there be? You know, at least 2,000, because they make these all run off and they drown. We also see some details about the demon-possessed man, that he has superhuman strength. The strongest thing that they had at that day was chains. We don't have much stronger. He's able to break them, fetters, you know, handcuffs basically. He's able to snap those off. He lives with the dead. He likes to surround himself with the dead. Many suspect necrophilia going on here. He roams about the countryside, crying and screaming out. He's in torment, you know, with whatever's in him. Cuts himself with stones. He wants to, you know, self-mutilation, you know, as part of his will, that he wants to self-mutilate. Let's add another detail to this, and there are a few more, from Luke. Look at Luke chapter 8. It kind of gives the one detail I was really wanting to pull. Luke 8, verse 26. We're kind of jumping into the story here since we've read it twice. It says, when he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and with a loud voice said, what have I to do with thee, Jesus, the Son of God, Most High? I beseech thee, torment me not. For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for oftentimes it had caught him, and he was kept bound with chains and fetters, and he brake the bands and was driven by the devil into the wilderness. When Jesus asked him, saying, what is thy name? He said, Legion, because many devils were entered into him. And they besought him that he would not command them to go into the deep. And when there was a herd of swine, and we know they eat bags, and they run off into it. So a few other details. One, I don't know that I read this part, but it says that he was naked. It might have been earlier in the story, and I cut it out. But it says he was naked. He says his name is Legion. And the Legion is a Roman regiment, which at the time of Augustus was 6,826 soldiers. And so this guy has at least 6,876, or unless he's a liar, but we know he at least has 2,000 because he had 2,000 pigs that he runs into, and they all go into the water and drown. But we learn this thing. This is what I was wanting to pull out of this one, verse 31. They besought him that he would not command them to go out into the deep. And they're not talking about the water that they drowned in. The word the deep here is abysso, or abyss. It's the bottomless pit. Often in the Bible, it's called the bottomless pit. It's called the pit, the abyss, and the bottomless pit, the abuso. And so we learn that the unclean spirits, or these devils, as is mentioned in these three encounters, fear the abyss. Don't do it yet. Can we still have our freedom? Don't send us there, because if we're there, we can't get out. Let's look at 2 Peter. This is all dovetail to where we were last week. 2 Peter chapter 2, probably one of the most skipped portions of Scripture, I would think, as guys go through it. Second Peter chapter 2 and verse 4 says, for if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment, and spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. And so he starts going on, and he even compares the next one to Sodom and Gomorrah. But we'll pick that up in another passage. And so here we see that God judged angels. Verse 4 says he spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell. And so he's judged them. So at least, he hasn't judged the good angels. He's only judged the fallen angels. And so we'd say, well, what sin is it that he's judged? Would be another question we'd put in our mind. We see that part of this judgment is that they are in chains of darkness. So first you just think, oh, they're in chains. But no, God gives it a descriptive term, chains of darkness. So in the Greek, it's more like chains of blackness. And so it's some blackness, the darkness of the netherworld, a gloomy cloud or a dark mist. And so it's someplace dark, 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 where light is not escaping. It says here that he cast them down to hell. But it's not the usual word hell that you find most other places in the New Testament. Most other places, when the word hell is used, it usually means Gehenna hell. That's the eternal lake of fire hell. Or it means Sheol, the temporary dwelling hell. But that's not the word hell that is used here. Peter says that these angels that sinned are in a pit. He calls the pit Tartarus, which is the deepest abyss in hell. And so it's the deep pit. It's the bottomless pit. It's the abyss or the abuso. Only thing he gives it the Greek name Tartarus because it has more meaning in the Greek culture. The deepest a pit in hell. So hell is dark, hell is down, hell is deep, but the Tartarus, or the bottomless pit, or the Abuso, is the deepest, darkest, worst part of the solitary confinement part of hell, I guess, that they are down in. So there are angels that are in chains of darkness that are in this deep, dark, bottom abode of the pit. I think in the Greek writings that aren't the Bible, they call it a gloomy abode of woe, is what Tartarus means in their description. But I'm giving the King James Version. Look at the book of Jude. So right before. Jude's said one chapter verse, and he said, I want to talk to you about something else, but God says, I need to tell you about this. Then he gets into some strange things as he goes at it. Verse 5 says, I will therefore put you into remembrance, though you once knew this, how that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed them that believed not. And the angels which kept not their first estate, so the same thing Peter's talking about, angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. And then he goes on, but he's likening these together. A few things to notice, that he compares the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah to the sins of the angels, where they went after strange flesh, or they went after strange flesh. They went after someone outside their own. And so some have wondered, the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, some try to make an excuse and say, oh, it's just inhospitable. You know, they weren't being nice to these visitors as the angels come to get Lot and his family out. You know, they were wanting to take in and rape them, and so that's what God judged them for. No, and I think we also know that they see the angels precede them as men, and the men were wanting them, you know, and so sin of homosexuality is there. But others even take it that they perceived and knew that they were angels and they were wanting to have sex with them, and so it really goes back to the original fallen angel sins that were going on. So I'm not sure there's enough there just with one of them, let alone that. You know, but God judges Sodom and Gomorrah for that. But he compares that likeness to it, that it's going after strange flesh. Verse 6, he also tells us that they are reserved. He says they are reserved in everlasting chains. Reserved means here that he guards it carefully. He watches over to make sure they make it to there. And so they're guarded in everlasting chains in the dark until judgment. Or something else. There's a couple of different outcomes, we think. And so they're reserved. They're held there. They don't have freedom. They don't run about to and fro over the face of the earth. And one last thing in this verse, it says that they left their own habitation, verse 6. And the angels which kept not the first estate, so they were in heaven, but they left their habitation, they fell. He has them reserved in this prison, in the gloomy chains of darkness, unto judgment of that great day. And so I'm assuming it's the same group of angels that Peter was talking about that are in this pit. So they left their own habitation. Some other versions have it their proper dwelling place. They left where they were made to be. Okay, I understand that. But the word is as okaterion. It means habitation. They left their habitation. And the definition fully goes on to say they left the body as a dwelling place of the spirit. And so something physically changed in them. When they left the spirit, they left the celestial heavenly body that they had for a lesser when they came down to the earth. It's only used one other place to help us get a fuller picture of the use of this word, and I think it really does help add to the depth of what leaving their habitation or leaving their okaterion means. But before we get to that, I want us to think a little bit. Think of heaven. Think of going to heaven, right? I don't think we do that often enough. A lot of people are like, oh, you know, your head's in the clouds. No, I think it's good to think about our eternal home, what we are fighting for, why we strive, why we battle, why we wage against sin, why we want to resist the devil and his minions and make him flee. So think of heaven. Think being in your glorified body. What do you look forward to in your glorified body? Right? It's going to be incorruptible. That means it won't sin. It's not susceptible to the curse. It won't have disease. It will not have aches and pains. It won't die. It's incorruptible. You know, it won't pass away. There's a news story about, hey, they pulled up this nun out of the grave, and it doesn't look like she's been rotten. You know, so they're making some big deal. I don't want that one. I want an incorruptible body that's alive and moving around. And so that's just one that's aging slowly or deteriorating slowly. We want a glorified body. It's going to be, changed. It's going to be a body of power, 1 Corinthians 15 tells us. It's going to be a spiritual body made for the heavenly realm that can exist for all eternity. It's going to be something that will not age, it will not wear out. It'll be like better than whatever we have that lasts a long time. It's going to be indelible. You know, it will not wear out. It's a celestial body, Paul calls it. It's made to live in the celestial realm, which, how many realms is that and how far can we travel? I don't know, but God's made it for us. You won't need a spacesuit. You won't need an oxygen tank. You won't need, we'll be able to live and go where all these realms are, which is fantastic for me. You'll be immortal. You won't die. We'll live forever. It's everlasting for those who repented and trusted in Jesus Christ. Now look at 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15 lists all these. I've listed a bunch of them without reading it, but I want to get to Paul's conclusion. 1 Corinthians 15 is a chapter you should know and understand because it is the resurrection chapter. It starts out with the gospel in a nutshell. He starts comparing it, Jesus Christ and Adam is the first Adam and the second Adam, and because in Adam we all die, in Christ we can all live. You know, he's making comparisons what we see. He talks about farming, the body that we plant and what grows a little bit differently. And then he starts talking about your glorified body, which is verse 42. It's sown, Paul talks about resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. Verse 43, it is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural and there is a spiritual body. It's a body that won't wear out. It doesn't mean you are a ghost. It is a tactable, tangible, physical body. But it's made to exist. I think that's why Paul uses celestial, even though he wrote this to describe it. But it's made for all eternity. It is sinless, it is unable to sin, it is a body made perfect for all eternity. But then you get to verse 51. He says, "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall be changed." He's speaking of the rapture. We don't all have to pass through death. He says, "But in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trump shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible." So they get their bodies first, and then we shall be changed. We don't have to die. Our body will be changed. You know, this body all of a sudden gets the upgrade, you know, it gets the boost that we never have to another one. "For this corruptible must put on incorruption, this mortal must put on immortality. So then this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality. Then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O great death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law, but thanks be to God, which give us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." He uses it as an encouragement to us. It's like, you're working for the Lord, you're suffering for the Lord, you're sweating for the Lord, you have a job to pay bills, to give to the church, to fund missionaries, you know, so that for the Lord, you know, God says, "I see all that, and one day I'll reward you, and I'm going to give you a glorified, powerful, immortal body that'll live forever." Oh, don't you yearn for that? Can't you say, "Hurry up, come quickly"? Now look at 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1 says, "For we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved," basically if our body dies, rots on the ground, "we have a building of God, and house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." And he's not talking about our eternal home or our abode or our dwelling place as far as in a place with a chimney and a fireplace. You know, he's talking about your body. He says, if your body dies here on earth, don't worry. God has a heavenly body for you. We're going to be tangible. We're not going to be ghosts. We're going to have a, because men are made as a body-soul unity. We're meant to be that way. We are tangible. We are physical. Verse 2, "For in this we groan earnestly, desiring to be clothed upon with our house, which is from heaven." We yearn for it. That's why I was trying to stir up in you by talking about the glorified body that we're going to have. So that we have this yearning for, boy, I can't wait till I get my glorified body. We're to yearn for it. Most oftentimes we yearn for it. One, the older we get, we yearn for it more. But it's that moan when it aches. You know, when you get up in the morning, you're kind of like, oh, Lord, how much longer? That's the kind of groan. Or that just, it's the sigh. Because the word here for yearning, or groaning about here is also a sigh. A sigh when you're like looking forward to the future. You're like, well, one day, Lord, right? I want to have this back that hurts and that sciatic won't be acting up and the bursitis and that, whatever else you got in your joint. You're like, oh, one day it'll all be done. I'll have this stiff neck. I'll be able to have a just One day, Lord, right? It's that sigh, that yearning, that little taste that all Christians have that we kind of do subtly that we really don't think about, that we probably ought to think about more, that we are desiring this. And Paul says, yeah, we desire that. But he uses that word, okaterion, here. It is the word house in verse 2. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon with our house, which is from heaven, our spiritual body, our habitation that we are going to have so we can live for eternity with God on reconstructed earth, you know, throughout all the celestial realm. And so, when you juxtapose these, when you look what this is what we're yearning to get, it's what the angels cast off. But there's something, there's a transaction that happened. When the angels gave up this body to come down to the earth to live lesser than what they were made, and we're yearning to be restored to what he made us in our original state, but we're in a fallen state, so we're yearning for that so we can live with him throughout all eternity, you know, that Adam had that went out, you know, when they realized that they were both naked, you know, and they had to make fig leaves to cover themselves. You know, something happened, and we believe the light went out. You know, they were clothed in the robes of righteousness, that the light went out. And so now we are yearning for that to come back. And so there's something that happened. We're not going to be angels. We're not yearning to, oh, I want to be an angel. We're not going to be an angel. You're going to be you. In a body that lasts for all eternity, that is the simple term we call it, is just glorified. We will shed death and will not be an enemy that we fear anymore. No seatbelts, no helmets, right? Pain will be gone, disease will be gone, sorrow and exhaustion will be gone. We'll be able to, hey, let's run up to Indianapolis. And I don't mean get in the car. We're like, no, let's run. And we'll race it. You won't be tired. And it's like, that'll be awesome, you know. We'll have a body that's not weak. We'll be able to do the things we desire to do, have it strong. We'll put on power, you know, boost modes, and be able to do whatever. So it'll be a glorified body, incorruptible, immortal, that's strong. The fallen angels cast off that body, it sounds like. So how do they mate with women? It's usually one of the big questions. Well, how did that happen? Yeah, because they sinned, and they cast off that body, and now they kind of have a natural body in that sense. So apparently all the plumbing works. So last week, we were in Genesis 6, and we talked about the angels and the women and making the babies that are the giants or the Nephilim, the Bible calls them. So they're like an angel-human half-breed that has become these monsters. We read a passage where it talked about how they, I read it from Enoch, which is an extra-biblical account, but it talked about how they ate everything, and then they began to eat people. So they introduced cannibalism. They begin to drink blood. They begin to eat each other, you know, and so they just become more and more vile, and the world became more and more rampant. We talked about the angels that came and made this pact, you know, to do this, that they taught things to mankind that made sin increase, how to make weapons and, you know, how to, all kinds of stuff we looked at. We can go through that again if you want. But after this, when God gives the Ten Commandments and the other laws, he makes sure he stresses throughout there that there's to be no mixing of kinds. It's like, you know, people with people, you know, animals with animals. You know, you're not to mix kinds. There's a prohibition on that that is pointed out several times in the book of Leviticus. Jesus warns that the last days will be like the days of Noah. They'll be in marriage and given in marriage. And that's kind of a nice way of saying that they'll be doing those things that make kids. And they did it with the angels back then. The only other time we've had genetically things mixed is now, where we take, it's not always through intercourse, or if that works at all, but it's through things like the CRISPR, or mRNA, where they can take DNA and change and alter it. Daniel 2 kind of talks about the mixing of kinds in the last day. Daniel 11 will again, and we'll point that out and tie those all together when we get there. But I want to look at something in Enoch again that kind of ties all this together. And just as a reminder, the book of Enoch is not in the Bible, nor should it be. We use archaeology to inform us about biblical times, to be able to teach and instruct. We use medical journals that talk about crucifixion and the suffering that Christ went through to add to it. You know, we're not adding to the Bible and saying, this medical journal should be in the Bible. No, it's just giving us more history. I think every pastor probably has a copy of Josephus in his library that tells about what the Jewish people thought at the time and what they were doing and their history and how it was interpreted by the Jews at that time. Should it be in the Bible? No. Does it inform every message? It informs a lot of our messages because it's how we think, how they thought, you know, because we have a book from that day that gives us this instruction. So it's just additional details. It's like a history book to help us. And so it was a book that was lost, that came back in abundance when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I just want to read verse 1 because I forgot to read it last week. It says, the words of the blessing of Enoch wherewith he blessed the elect and righteous who will be living in the day of tribulation, when all the wicked and the godless are to be removed. He says, this book was written for those in the last days to understand what it was like in the time before the flood. And so maybe that's why it's been released to us today. I don't know. But it does give us some interesting things, and we're not going to get into all of it, but I just want to start it. Chapter 10 of Enoch, verse 2. A couple of you have it on your phone, so that's why I said it. But it says, go to Noah, and this is when the angels have heard the cry of the violence on the world, and people are screaming, and the animals that have been killed and eaten, you know, because it was vegetarian before, and all the blood eating, and all the cannibalism, and all this stuff. This group of angels gets together, and you have Michael and Gabriel, and a couple others, like Raphael and Uriel, that Enoch tells us about, that they're making a plea unto God. And so now God's given his decree. He says, go to Noah and tell him my name, hide thyself, Tell him, hide thyself, and reveal to him the end is approaching, that the whole earth may be destroyed, and the deluge is about to come upon the whole earth and destroy all that is on it. Now instruct him that he may escape, and his seed may be preserved for all the generations of the world. And again the Lord said unto Raphael, that's this other angel, bind Azazel hand and foot. He's the one who taught all the instruments of war and makeup and a bunch of things about altering creation. And cast him into the darkness, and make an opening in the desert, which is Dudel, and cast him therein. So make a big pit and cast him in it. Place upon him a rough and jagged rock, and cover him with darkness, and let him abide there forever, and cover his face that he may see no light, and a gloomy abode of woe. Verse 6, and on the day of the great judgment he shall be cast into the lake of fire, and heal the earth which the angels have corrupted, and proclaim the healing of the earth, that they may heal the plague, and that all the children of men may not perish through all the secret things that the watchers have disclosed and have taught their sons. And the whole earth has been corrupted through the works of, that were taught by Azazel. To him ascribe all sin. So he puts a lot of the blame, even though we saw that there was 200, but Azazel gets most of the blame. He gets thrown in this pit out in the desert. And Gabriel said to the Lord, proceed against the bastards and the reprobates and against the children of the fornication, and destroy the children of fornication and the children of the watchers from amongst men, this is the giants, and cause them to go forth, and send them one against the other, that they may destroy each other in battle, for the length of the days they shall not have. And so they're going to be destroyed. And I'm trying to skip some. I'm going to skip the rest of that. And so they're all destroyed, and the angels are to watch the kids be destroyed. Oh, verse 12 says, and when the sons have slain one another, then shall, and they have seen the destruction of their beloved ones, because the angels in Enoch's account said they really loved their kids and really proud of these giants and all the wicked things that they did. Isn't he sweet, killing all those people? It's a perversity that they have. He says, bind them fast for 70 generations in the valleys of the earth, till the day of their judgment and of the consummation, till the judgment of this and ever is consummated. So a bunch of them were to be held just for 70 generations, which works out to be, if you do the math, however long a generation is, about now, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 years. And so 6,000 or 7,000 years, then we'll let them out. So if we looked at Revelation 9, if you'll give me like 5 minutes extra here. Revelation 9 and verse 1. No, we'll start at verse 14. Revelation 9 and verse 14. So it says unto the sixth angel which had a trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. Oh, a lot of times we read the Revelation, we're like, well, who are these angels that are bound and why are they in the river Euphrates? If Enoch is to be believed as a historical book, which we think it can because it is quoted by Jude and referenced or referred to by most of the New Testament writers. Again, we're not saying it's scripture, but these angels are held in judgment in the river Euphrates, but there comes a time when they are let out, 70 generations, what Jude or Enoch says. And so they were let out, verse 15, and the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for to slay a third of part of men. So these are wicked men that want to, wicked beings that want to kill, and they let them loose and they kill one third of mankind that's alive at that time. Chapter 9, verse 1 says, the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven from the earth, and to him was given a key to the bottomless pit or the abyss or the abuso or Tartarus. Verse 2, and he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose smoke out of the pit, and the smoke of a great furnace, as a smoke of the great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and upon them was given power, and the scorpions of the earth have power, and they sting, and they go after all those who have the mark. And so a bunch of them are loosed out of the pit, probably about 70 generations later, maybe. So we have all these that are let out from these different ones, because it said they're in different valleys. Now look at Yeah, let's get this real quick. Leviticus 16. It only makes sense if we do this all at once. Leviticus 16, verse 3. I'm going to just tell you part of this for time's sake. Leviticus 16, verse 3, he starts telling the priests how they're going to do the offering on the Day of Atonement, how they're going to take two goats, and they're going to cast lots for them. Aaron has to cast, has some sacrifice for himself because he's going to be the representative. But if you look at verse 7, Leviticus 16, verse 7, and he shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and Aaron shall cast lots upon the two goats, one for the Lord and the other for the scapegoat. And so there's two goats, and they have this pot that had two things in them, one for the Lord, one for the scapegoat, whichever it came out. That one was for the Lord, the other was for the scapegoat. One is sacrificed and offered for the Lord. The other one he comes back, lays hands on, and transfers the sins of the nation, as him being the high priest representing the Jewish people, he transfers the sin of the entire nation onto this goat. It is then given to a fit man or a strong man. Look at verse 21. And Aaron shall lay both his hands upon the head of the live goat and confess over him and all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all the transgressors of their sins, putting them upon the head of the goat, and he shall send him away by the hand of a fit man or a strong man into the wilderness. And the goat shall bear upon him all their iniquities, and shall, and the land shall not be inhabited, and he shall let go the goat in the wilderness. And then Aaron's doing his part back this way. So Aaron is doing his proceedings. He's sacrificing the other animals. This fit man gets the goat, the scapegoat that has all the sins laid on it, and he takes it out into the wilderness. And it says it's not to return. The Jewish writings tell us that it doesn't return because the fit man takes it up on this hill. And when he gets over the hill, over a place called the pit, he kicks it. And as the goat falls off the hill, they said it hits so hard so many times down the side of this cliff that it is dismembered by the time it's halfway down. And it falls into this pit. And so, kind of a weird thing that's going on. And so, the thing that's hidden from our eyes as we read it in the King James and other versions is verse 8. Verse 8, when it gets to the end, it says we have these two goats. One is for the Lord and the other is for the scapegoat. The word scapegoat there in Hebrew is the word Azazel, the same angel that was cast into this deep pit that had all the sharp rocks put around him. He was wrapped up in chains of gloomy darkness that held him there. Is at the bottom of this pit that they take a goat out to each and every year with the sins of Israel upon it, and God adds more sins to it. He says, you got more sins on your shoulders. They kick it down in this hole, and it goes down on top of him, and so his judgment increases because all the things that he introduced into this world that made men worse than we were even from the fall from Adam and Eve. And so it's the word Azazel. So one of the fallen angels is listed in the King James Version of the Bible, or in the Hebrew Bible, right there, Azazel. And it's mentioned in here a couple of times, but it's always as the scapegoat. And so he is in there, so it kind of helps add credence that we can get some insight from the book of Enoch. And so Azazel, as it's mean, or the scapegoat here in verse 8, means it's the proper name of a fallen angel, Azazel. One of the 200 who took an oath to have sex with women is part of the definition. And so him and 199 others are cast into the pit until the judgment, and then they are loosed in Revelation 9 or thereabouts. And just before we quit, let's look at one other thing in Revelation 20. Just to bring it full circle, to understand, to help us understand what is being said about here in Revelation, which is what Daniel 11 is going to start talking about. We're going to get in Daniel 11 and 12 more details that add on top of what we learn in the book of Revelation. So in Revelation 20, it's at the end of the tribulation. The battle of Armageddon has happened. The false prophet and the beast have been cast alive into the eternal damnation, the lake of fire, Gehenna, hell. And then we have this that happens in chapter 20, verse 1. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit, the abuso, Tartarus, this deep, dark pit of hell. And a great chain was in his hand, and he laid hold of that dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan. And he bound him for 1,000 years. So he locks him up, not for 70 generations, but for 1,000 years he puts him in there. And he cast him into the bottomless pit, the abuso, the abyss, and shut him up and set a seal upon him that he should not deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years shall be fulfilled, and after that he must be loosed a little season. So he has the promise of being loosed again too, just like these others were. So it's kind of, we have pattern, a pattern from before You bind them up and put them in a pit. I'll let them out just for a little bit. At the end, then I'll judge them with a strict judgment. Satan gets the same thing. He is finally put into a pit. He's not in there now because apparently he wasn't part of the 200 who made this pact to come unto women and to have sex with them. But now he is, which makes me think he must do that in the second incursion, or as what it's called, or here towards the end. I think we can develop that more a little bit more next week. But so he's cast in here, but it's only for a little while. If you go down to verse 7, it says, "And when the 1,000 years were expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and he shall go forth and deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them." It's no great battle. Verse 10, "And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are, and he shall be tormented day and night forever and ever." So he's no longer in the abyss. He's moved to Gehenna, the lake of fire, and the deepest part there. And so, what about the giants? We'll pick that up next week because I already went 5 minutes over. But we'll look at them. Well, what happens to them? You know, if they're not in the abyss, they're not there. So some of the angels that are in the abyss are the ones that committed a sin where they crossed species when they weren't supposed to. The devil's still free. Job tells us he goes before the Lord, still accusing us. And so we'll look into a little bit more of what they're doing next week. But I'll probably try to wrap it up then so we can get back to our Daniel. And so just a little thing to kind of keep things straight in our mind, because the fallen angels are locked up, parts of them. I think angels are still falling. We can look at that a little bit next week. But think on these questions and ponder it and see how all this kind of plays together. To know that there are spiritual forces at work that we are battling against for sure, because that's what Daniel's telling us about. And they're being loosed, or more showing themselves as the days are approaching. We'll look at a passage in Isaiah that talks about God's going to use them again. And I think that's probably the days that we're being prepared for sure, as we see more and more wickedness upon the face of this earth that's being more and more pulled out. My whole family's talked about how we dread, what is it, tomorrow? When the month comes and it is going to be crammed in our faces, and it's worse and worse, right? You know, Target has clothes made by a Satanist, you know, towards little bitty kids, you know, for body modification and weird sexual things. Why? Because they're perverse, because it's evil, because there's powers and forces that are behind it, and the veil's been torn down, and the more we run God out, and the more we let him in, the more they show themselves, and so that's what we're facing. And so, yeah, we all need to get together and pray. Yeah, we need to do the Bible study. We need to study, and we need to rebuke them and know that he who is for us is greater than them, that we win. Resist the devil, and he will flee. And so we're to do our part in that, and let's not forget it. That Jesus Christ is the victory. Jesus Christ wins. The devil's a loser. He eats with the whole phrase, "Eat my dust," comes from that. He's going to stomp on his head, and he's going to eat God's dust. And so all the days of his life. And so victory is ours. Let's not let's keep that in mind. Our God is greater. Our God is stronger. And so we're not to be defeated. Let's go to prayer. Lord, we thank you so much for this day. We thank you for this time that we've had, Lord, to go through your word and Lord, to get some extra insights there. Lord, just pray that we help these things, keep them balanced and to know, but I think we can chase them all down and see how a lot of this lines up. And Lord, we just want to have a better understanding so that we're not deceived. And Lord, that we know that your strengths are over them all, that you're the creator, and that you're the one that has a judgment day sentence for them. They feared you on earth. They fear you now. And Lord, when we are in filled and empowered by you, Lord, that you are working within us. And Lord, we pray that we would just keep short accounts, that we would keep the sin list long, and Lord, our relationship with you right, so that we can be strong soldiers for you, Lord, as we go forth and to resist the devil and tell him to flee. Just be with us, watch over and protect us, be with those on the list that we prayed for. See us all safely home there this night, Lord, and help us as we ponder these things. We just pray this in your Son, Jesus' precious and holy name.